Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Jeannie Smith, the daughter of Polish Holocaust rescuer Irena Gut-Opdyke, who passed away on May 17, 2003. Irena, the author of In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer, received international recognition for her actions during the Holocaust while working for a high-ranking German official. Her life story was performed on Broadway in the nationally acclaimed play Irena's Vow, starring Tova Feldschuh. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 25, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carrie Meyer, Director of Curatorial and Education Services at the Durham Museum.
Well, one thing that makes the museum unique is its ability to transport you through time. People tend to come here to go somewhere else. And tonight, we are going to go back to World War II, to 1940s. And we will follow the life story of Polish rescuer Irene Gut-Opdyke. Irene was one of five daughters born to a Catholic family. Throughout World War II, she cared for and hid Jews from the Nazis, and after the war, eventually made her way to America. Sadly, on May 17, 2003, Irene passed away. She received international recognition for her actions during the Holocaust. Her life story was performed on Broadway in the nationally acclaimed play, Irena's Vow. Her book, In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer, gives a detailed account of her life during World War II, and is used in classrooms around the country. With us tonight is Jeannie Smith, Irene's daughter and only child. Jeannie is part of a new generation of Holocaust speakers who spends the bulk of her time traveling across the country, sharing her mother's remarkable story. Please welcome Miss Jeannie Smith.
Good evening. This is my very first time to Nebraska, so first time to Omaha, and you guys are some pretty friendly people with good food. Yeah. Anyway, it is an honor to be asked to be here, and if any time I don't talk loud enough, please wave your hand, and I'll do my best to speak up. My mother was born in Poland. And if she were here today, you'd see this woman about this tall. White fluffy hair, big blue eyes, and an accent like Zsa Zsa Gabor's. She would sound like this when she would go to speak to schools. Good evening, my darling's childrens. I am so happy seeing all your beautiful faces. And I must tell you that I have come here today because I love you. She would say that every single time. And it truly is my prayer every time I get the opportunity to share her story that that love could flow through, because we all could use a whole lot more of it. Mom was born Irena Gut. Her father was an architect, her mom was a homemaker, and mom was the oldest of five beautiful sisters, she used to say. Her family was not, and her home was not very far from the German border, but when mom graduated high school, her dream was to become a nurse. And so her parents sent her off to nursing school, almost on the other end of Poland. It was exciting because she'd never been away from home before, and also a little nerve-wracking, but she went with full gusto. But one morning, she walked out of the school building. It was September 1st, 1939. She said it had been a sunny morning, but the sun was gone, because overhead there was airplanes flying all over, dropping bombs everywhere. Without any warning, Hitler had invaded Poland. And all communication was immediately cut off. There was no way for mom to call home and find out if her parents were okay, if her sisters were all right, and they couldn't find out about her. They turned her school into a makeshift hospital as she did what she could to help take care of people that were wounded and injured, But 16 days later, Stalin from the Soviet Union also invaded Poland from the other end. And just like this, her whole country was gone. She said one afternoon there was a group of people who came by. They called themselves the Polish Underground, or the Partisans. And they were looking for volunteers, people to join up and go out into the woods and fight the enemies that had taken over their country. Well, some of the teachers joined up, and Mom, who was just 18, she joined up too. She said they literally had to go into the forest and dig holes in the forest floor to live in. They covered themselves with tarps, and they had some ammunition, a couple of radios, but it starts getting very cold in Poland in the fall, and they didn't have enough warm clothing or supplies, and so it was decided that a small group would go to a nearby town to get some more things. Mom was part of this group, too. She said they had to walk through the forest, and when they got to the edge of the forest, to the road that would lead to town, the older people in the group said, "Irene, you stay back. Mark the trail. We'll go get what we need and come back." So she said she stood there all by herself. And she couldn't see it, but she could smell a bakery at the end of the town that these people were going to, and that it was baking up hot, fresh cinnamon rolls. You know how good that smells? When you're starving, the smell was intoxicating, and she was concentrating so hard on that that she didn't see or hear a truck full of Soviet soldiers coming her way. But those soldiers saw her, and they jumped out of the truck and they chased her. She ran as fast as she could, but they caught her and they beat her. They ripped her clothes off, gang raped her, and left her for dead in the snow. I don't know how long she laid there, but eventually another truck full of Soviet soldiers came by and they saw her little body there. They picked her up, threw her in the back of their truck, and dropped her off at a Soviet hospital where she stayed for a long time because her injuries were really severe. But unlike hospitals today, that when you're better, you get to leave, because of her involvement with the Partisans, she was not free to leave. She became a forced laborer there in that hospital. But at one point, she found a way to escape. She got out a second-story window. She fit through a little crack in the fence, and she ran as fast as she could. She wasn't even sure where she was, but she hoped maybe a town or two away, she had an aunt that lived somewhere in that vicinity, and so this time, very carefully, she made her way through the streets. But one evening, she said she came to a part of the town that was just strange. She said the whole area had chain-link fencing around it. Barbed wire was strung up on top, but the streets were empty. Doors to buildings and homes were left wide open, windows broken, but no one in sight. It was getting late and she was tired, so she went into a building, went upstairs and fell asleep on a second-story floor. But in the morning, she woke up to screaming and shouting down in the street. She said she went to the window and she looked down, and she saw a sight no one was meant to see. Our history books refer to it as a death march. But what Mom saw was a mass of people being herded down the street like they were cattle. They were Jews. She could tell because Jews were forced to wear bands on their arm with the Star of David on them. But to Mom, she said, this group of people was like if the police came to where you live, to your neighborhood, and they broke into every single house and drug everyone out. There was a cross-section from senior citizens all the way down to newborns, families of all ages and sizes. Mom noticed one young mother walking with a tiny child. And a German soldier came up to her, and he grabbed that baby, threw it in the air, and shot it like it was a bird. She watched as they continued to walk down the streets of the town, and she snuck downstairs and followed at a distance. At the edge of town, there was a large field, and someone had dug a great big pit in that field. The Jews were forced to stand around the edge of that pit, and Mom found a fence and hid behind it. and watched. She watched the parents cover their children's eyes with their hands, and she watched as they were shot and fell into the pit. Now, my mom was raised Catholic, and she had a simple, childlike faith. But she said, watching this horrific event, she said, I raised my eyes to the heavens, and I screamed out, my God, where are you? How can you let something like this happen? I don't understand. She was so upset that she screamed out, I don't even believe you're there. But as she kept walking, she said, there was one thought that settled into her heart, into her soul, and it was this. God gives us free will to be good or bad, to help and heal or to hurt and harm. And it's up to us to decide what we'll do. And she said it was right then and there that she made a promise, a vow, that if there was ever any opportunity for her to help, she would. And she kept walking, and she finally found the right town where she knew her aunt lived, the right street, the right house. And just as she was coming up to the walkway, the front door opened up, and out came Mom's four sisters. The whole family had gone there looking for her, and she had a wonderful reunion with them. But it was very short-lived, because the Germans, they came and they took her father away. He was an architect. They wanted him to build factories for the German war front. And in war, you do what you're told, or you're killed. And so my grandfather and grandmother and the three younger of my mom's sisters, they went off to be with him. But they didn't take my mom or the next oldest sister, Janina, because where they were going was next to a facility where they trained German soldiers, and they didn't want the two teenage girls being close to that. A couple weeks later, my mom and sister and aunt, they went to church one Sunday morning, and when they left the building, they found that they were surrounded by German soldiers who pushed and shoved and segregated people. If you were very old, you were put aside, and very young, you were put aside. But everybody who was capable of work, you'd be put on trucks. My mom was put on a truck separated from her family and taken to the town of Tarnopol, which was then in Poland, and forced to work in a munitions factory making ammunition for the German war front. The conditions in the factory were terrible. It was freezing cold. There was barely enough to eat, and Mom became very anemic. And one day, a high-ranking German official came to that factory to make sure that production was being kept up. And when he walked by my mom's section, she ended up fainting right at his feet. And when she woke up, she was in the office with this man, and she was so terrified that if he thought she couldn't do the work, he'd send her even further away or just have her killed. And so she pleaded with him, please, sir, I haven't been well, but I'm strong, and I can learn, and I can do this job. Give me one more chance, please. This major, who was in his 60s, looked at this 18-year-old, blonde, blue-eyed, very Aryan-looking girl whose last name was Gut, and my mom, because she grew up on the Polish-German border, could speak German. And he asked her, are you a German girl? She answered truthfully, no, I'm Polish. He said, I like that you're honest, but it's apparent you can't do the work here. You'll come with me. I'll give you another job. So she went with him to the camp that he was in charge of. It wasn't a concentration camp. It was a camp that housed German officers and secretaries and soldiers. And Mom's job would be serving meals in the diner, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And she was given one other job, and that was to oversee the laundry room. And it was in the laundry room that she was introduced to the 12 Jewish people who were forced to work there. One was a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, an accountant, a nurse, there were married couples. These were all people of means, people with beautiful homes filled with precious things that we all have in our homes. And everything they had been taken from them, given to someone else, and now they were forced to live in the ghetto next door and take care of their captives' clothes. Yet these were the lucky Jews. they weren't in a concentration camp, but they were starving. But Mom could easily sneak food from the diner, enough to give them, in fact, enough extra food for them to distribute amongst the ghetto. More important than food, Mom realized that when she was serving meals in the diner and the SS or the Gestapo were in there, she could be a spy, listening to when they were discussing raids where they would go into a new section of town, and without any permission, they would bust into your house and they would search it from the attic to the basement to see if you were hiding a Jew. And if one was found, your whole family and the Jews you were hiding would be taken and killed. She could get that information to her friends, and they could spread it amongst the ghetto. And because of their networking, hundreds of people were able to leave before their areas were raided. But one evening, the major had at his table one of the heads of the Nazi party. And when she went to serve him, she heard the Nazi tell the major, "Next week, don't plan on having any of your Jews here." The major argued, "What are you talking about? I've got quotas to fill. How am I going to get my work done without my workers?" And the Nazi said, "You hire Poles, gypsies. I don't care. I have my orders that by this time next week, there won't be one Jew left alive." And Mom knew that that meant her friends, even in the laundry room. And she had the very difficult decision on whether she should tell them that a week from now, even the little bit they had would be gone. But finally she decided she had to, and when she did, they pleaded with her, "Irene, help us. Hide us, do something." She said, "I've got a little room above the diner. I've got a single cot to sleep in and a washbowl to clean myself with. I've got no place to hide 12 people." But that night she got down on her knees and she prayed for a miracle. And in the morning, she had one, because the major came to her and he said, "I'm taking a villa at the end of town. I'm going to be doing a lot of entertaining, and you're going to come and be my housekeeper." She went that day with him in his horse and wagon. They rode down the streets of the town until they got to a big, beautiful mansion on a corner lot. And Mom said when she walked up to the front door, she noticed a mezuzah there on the doorpost. It told her that a Jewish family lived there, a wealthy Jewish family. And there was a very good chance that if a wealthy Jewish family built a house in that part of Europe, somewhere in that house there might be a hiding place. And so she asked the major for a pass so she could go from the camp to the villa over the next couple of days to get things ready. And over the next couple of days, she helped all 12 of her friends escape from the camp, down the streets of the town, to the villa, down a coal chute, and into the basement, until they were all there, all 12 of them, in the basement of the German major's house. She breathed a sigh of relief until the major came and he walked through the place. "Irene, this house is filthy. I want it scrubbed and I want it painted from top to bottom." And he made Mom arrive the next day with a squad of German soldiers ready to do just that. She kept her friends quiet in the basement and started the soldiers upstairs. And when they were finished, she brought the soldiers from the front staircase down, took her friends from the back staircase, hid them in a tiny spot in the attic until the house was cleaned and painted. Finally, the soldiers left and she was able to bring her friends back down to the basement and breathe a sigh of relief. Until the major walked through the place. "Irene, the house looks much better. We'll start entertaining soon. There'll be big parties, a lot of work, but not to worry. I'm going to bring a soldier who can help you with everything. He can live here in the basement." That wouldn't work. And so she pleaded with him, "Please, don't bring a soldier in here. I'd be a nervous wreck having a man here with me all day long." She had to tell him what had happened to her with the Soviets about the rapes. He said, "Don't be an idiot. Nothing's going to happen to you in my house. You're perfectly safe here." But she pleaded, she begged, she assured him she could do every bit of work. He said, Irene, we're going to have parties for 30, 40, 50 people a night. Besides the shopping and cooking and cleaning, there's heavy lifting and repair work, gardening, laundry, ironing. There's no way one person can do all that. I can, she said. You'll see. I can do it. She begged. She pleaded until finally he said, enough. I'll give you one chance. The first time you embarrass me, the first time you can't keep up, my soldier comes in. So they had a great arrangement because every morning the major would get up, have breakfast, and he'd leave the villa to go to his office. And Mom would follow behind with her key. And as soon as he left, she'd put her key in the doorknob. That way, if he came home before he was supposed to, his key wouldn't unlock the door, and he'd have to ring the bell. Mom had one of the men down in the basement rig up an alarm bell that she could buzz upstairs if there was any problems. They could hear it down below and know to be quiet. While they were free in the daytime, Mom had them look and hunt everywhere in that villa for the hiding place that they hoped they would find. And sure enough, they found one. Down in the basement, you had to lay on your stomach on the ground, but there was one panel of wood on the wall that could be removed. And when it was, you saw a tunnel that wrapped around the whole side of the villa and ended in a small room that sat just underneath the gazebo in the side yard, a room just big enough to squeeze 12 people in. So every day the major would get up, have breakfast, grab his hat, his coat, his briefcase, and head out the door. Mom would follow with her key, put it in the lock, and then run to the basement door and open it up, and all 12 of her friends would come up. The men did the heavy lifting, the repair work. The women did the cooking, the cleaning, the polishing, the laundry, the ironing. And every day the major came home amazed that a teenager could accomplish so much. The nights were filled with parties where the Gestapo dined on the food that the Jews had made earlier that day. The Jews that had to be so quiet during these times, they couldn't cough or sneeze for fear of being found out. That's how they lived for almost 2 years, until two of the 12 in the basement, they were a married couple, Ida and Laser Holler. They'd been married for years and had never been able to have children, and now found out that they were expecting a baby that would cry and give them all away. These parents desperately wanted the child, but they felt like they had no choice, and my mom was presented with a list of supplies needed to terminate the pregnancy. She pleaded with them. Please don't do this, Ida Laser. I don't know why. I believe it's a sign that we'll be okay, that everything will work out. I've already seen so many innocent people murdered. Hitler's not going to have this baby. Took a lot of convincing, but finally they all agreed, we'll either all live together or we'll all die together. And life went on. Until one day, Mom had to go to town to get some more supplies for another upcoming party. And when she was in the store, two German soldiers came in and yelled at everyone, "Get outside!" She had no idea what was going on, but when she walked out of the store, she realized the whole town had been evacuated. Everyone in every building and store was now standing on either side of the sidewalk. In the middle of the street, there was a set of gallows that had been erected. There was a Polish family with two small children, and they had been caught hiding a Jewish family with a small child in their house. You have to understand that in Poland, on every street corner, on every building, there was signs saying what would happen if you befriended a Jew. Death would happen if you got caught giving a Jew a piece of bread. And that day, everybody in town was forced to stand and watch what that looked like. Mom said that they hung the children first and made the parents watch. And she said, I stood there with my eyes closed. But you can see even with your eyes closed, because you can hear and you can feel what's happening. And it was that day, walking back to the villa, she said, I was like a zombie. All she could think of is, I can't tell my friends what I've seen. There's nothing they could do about it. It would just upset them. But because she was so shook up, when she got back to the villa, she forgot to do what she had done every other day. She went to the kitchen and she put her groceries down, opened up the basement door, let three of the women come up, help her with the evening meal. She said, we were standing there cooking and talking, and all of a sudden there was a noise at the kitchen door, and they turned, and there was the major standing there, eyes bulging, chin shaking. He turned right around and he went to his office where the telephone was. Mom told her friends, get downstairs, and she said, I ran after him, and I grabbed a hold of his legs to stop him. And he turned around and screamed at her, how could you do this in my own home, under my own nose, after all I've done for you? Why? Of course, she was crying. They're my friends. No one has the right to kill because of race or religion. These people, they've done nothing wrong. Kill me. Punish me. But let them go. They're innocent. He screamed, turn you in? You think I can march you down to the Gestapo and tell them I didn't know I had Jews hiding in my own house? You've killed us all. I have to have time to think. I'm going to go to my office, and when I do, don't you go anywhere. Don't you talk to anyone. As soon as he left, she ran in the kitchen. She got food and water, went down to the basement, gave it to her friends, and said, get in the hiding place. If I don't come back in 3 days, means I'm dead. You'll have to get yourself out. And she went back upstairs to wait. Finally, he came back and went into his office, and she had no choice but to go and face him, find out the decision of life or death. And when she stood in front of him, he reached out and grabbed her by the waist, pulled her down on his lap. I've made a decision. I'm going to keep your secret, but for a price. You have to be mine anytime I ask, and willingly. Mom said there was no decision to be made. There was too many lives at stake. And she never told her friends in the basement what she had to do in order for them to stay alive. She said their integrity would have never let her make that decision. But they did all survive. And eventually, the Soviets started pushing the Germans out of Poland. The whole war front was beginning to collapse. And the major came to Mom at one point and said, I've got orders to move my unit. Are you coming with me? I want to find my family. It had been over 5 years. She didn't know if her parents and sisters were okay, if they were alive, if her house was still standing. And as he started getting ready to move out, Mom contacted her friends, the partisans, who were still out there in the forest, and said, make room. I'm bringing you 12 people and one very pregnant woman. She took the major's wagon and took her friends by two, laid them in the bottom of the wagon, covered them with blankets and shovels, food, things you'd need to live in the forest, and rode from the villa to the edge of the forest to the partisans, back and forth, until all 12 of them were there. And she stayed with them that last trip. And 6 days later, a little baby boy was born out there in those woods in freedom. Ida and Laser named their son Roman, Roman Holler. Mom said holding that baby was her payment in full for everything she'd gone through. Now her friends wanted her to continue staying in the forest because it's quite a dangerous place when a war front collapses. But she wanted to find her family, and she left. A lot of things happened during that time, but at one point Mom was captured, this time by the Soviets. After all, she'd been the mistress of a high-ranking German official, and the Soviets accused her of being a spy. Now she was put in a concentration camp, told she'd be sent to Siberia for the rest of her life. She would just disappear off the face of the earth. And she truly thought her life was over. The Soviets hired men on a daily basis to deliver food to the prisoners, and a lot of times they hired Jewish men. After Mom had been in the camp 2 or 3 months, one of the Jewish men they hired happened to be one of the men she'd hid in the basement of the major's house. And when he came, he saw her out in the crowd and he called out, "Irene, what are you doing here?" She was so overwhelmed at seeing a familiar face, she said, "I couldn't even speak." He came back later that night with friends, and they smuggled her out of that camp. They dyed her blonde hair black, gave her a false identity papers. She wasn't going to be Irena Gut, Polish Catholic. Now she was Sonia Silverstein, a Jewish refugee. They smuggled her out of Poland into Germany and put her in a displaced persons camp, where she sat for 2 years trying to put her life together. She found out her father had been shot and killed by the Germans for refusing to move off the sidewalk. Her mother had suffered a stroke and didn't survive. She couldn't find out anything about her 4 younger sisters and assumed that they were dead as well. As the war was winding down, there was a group of men from the United Nations who came to do interviews of the survivors. And there was an American delegate who came to the camp Mom was at. He could speak English and French, and he interviewed Mom, who could speak Polish, German, Russian, and some Yiddish. And through an interpreter, she told him her story. And when she was done, he said, "The United States of America would be very honored to have you." She wanted to try and stay in Poland, try and find her sisters if they were alive, but she was afraid. She was now wanted by the Germans and the Russians. And she was afraid if any of her sisters survived, she could bring great trouble to them. So in 1949, she came on a cargo ship to the United States and into Ellis Island. I loved that part of the story when she used to tell it. Standing on the bow of that boat, seeing the Statue of Liberty, she said, "I'm in a free country. I have a fresh start, a new beginning." And she said, "I put a do not disturb sign over all my memories. I will never think about or talk about what I've gone through. My life starts new here." She didn't have any money. She had not one word of English, and she had nobody meeting her here. But she could speak Yiddish, and she was in New York. She made a lot of wonderful Jewish friends that helped her find a job in the garment district, helped her get a little apartment. It took her 5 years, but she became a United States citizen. And nobody loved this country as much as she did. To celebrate, she decided to go to a fancy restaurant in Manhattan for lunch. It was really crowded that day. In fact, there was just one empty chair in the whole place right next to her. And as she was eating, a man came up and said, "May I sit here?" And then he looked at her. "I know you," he said. He was the UN delegate who'd interviewed her in the displaced persons camp in Germany. The very man that invited her to the United States. Well, he asked that pretty young blonde to dinner that night, and the next night, and 6 weeks later, they were married. My parents moved from the East Coast out to Southern California, where I was born, and Mom became an interior decorator. She was really good, too. She could sell ice to Eskimos. She could sketch, she could draw, and with that little Zsa Zsa Gabor voice, she could come into your house. "Oh, darling, we can do this, or we can do that, and it will be beautiful." And until I was 14 years old, that's all I knew about my mom, that she was extremely beautiful and talented and oh so elegant. I never heard any of these stories. True to her word, she'd kept that do not disturb sign up. It wasn't until we were having dinner one night, the three of us, and the telephone rang, and Mom got up to answer it, and on the other end of the line was a college student who was doing a report for school. His topic? The Holocaust never happened. It's just propaganda drummed up by the Jews so we'd feel sorry for them. And he was calling random people to find out what they thought. We all found out that night what she thought about that. You know, I still remember her face when she finally hung up the phone, tears streaming down her face from bringing these memories up. She looked at us and said, "Oh my God, all these years that I've kept silent, I've allowed evil. I've allowed the enemy to win, because when we don't speak out about what hate does, history can continue to repeat itself. And she said, I'm willing from now on to go anywhere to talk to any group so that these things will never happen again. And boy, it didn't take very long for her to stop being an interior decorator and do just that, travel all over the country. I usually stop right here because I forgot to give you the title for this whole talk. And it's really a weird title for a Holocaust talk, probably not one you've ever heard before. But it's love. Told you it was weird. But it's love that's required for something like this to never happen again. It's love that's required for us to look at someone else who's different, who believes different, who talks different, who thinks different, say, you are part of my human family, and we are connected, and I will stand with you. And you know one thing I've learned for certain as my mom's daughter? That when you're willing to love like that, unconditionally, your life goes from this size till there's no amount of how big it can go. It's true. I've seen it for myself. In 1982, my mom received a phone call from a young man named Roman Holler. You remember who he is? That baby born in the forest. Only he wasn't a baby anymore. He was a grown man whose son was about ready to be bar mitzvahed. Meant he was 13. He looked all over the world for my mom, whom he called his mom, so that she could go to Israel and be a part of that ceremony. But she found out something incredible when she met up with Roman, and that's what happened to the major that she'd lived with as his housekeeper. When the war was over, Major Edward Rugemer, that was his name, he finally ended up going back to his wife in Germany. Only his wife heard that he'd had a long affair with his young Polish housekeeper, and she wanted nothing to do with him. She refused to let him back into the house. And so he went to his friends in town, men he'd known his whole life. But there was rumors going around about the major. He'd become a Jew sympathizer. And there was big fear associated with that. And nobody would let this man, now very close to 70 years old, in their home. He had nowhere to go. He was literally forced to live on the streets, a homeless man. When Ida and Laser heard about what happened to the major, they were still living in Germany at that time, they put baby Roman in the back seat, and they drove to that town, and they searched the street, and they looked at every homeless face until they found him. And then they put him in the back seat with Roman and took him home. And Roman grew up calling him grandfather until the day he died. Can I add another word to love? Forgiveness. Do you know what real power is? Real strength? Something that's stronger than any army or any weapon? It's those two things, love and forgiveness. They can soften the hardest of hearts. They can open the most closed minds. In 1984, my mom was speaking in Los Angeles to a large group of people, and there was a couple right in the front row who came up afterwards, and they said, Irene, we're going to Poland. We'd love to try and help you find your sisters. It had been 40 years, and she explained to them, I've looked for my sisters. I can't find them. I don't believe they're alive. Maybe one has survived, but she would certainly be married with different last name. She gave what she knew, Janina, Maria, Bronia, Wajagut, and didn't think any more of it. This couple, they went to Poland, and they were diligent. They checked with the consulate and the embassy and with every local Catholic church they could find and came up with nothing. On the last day, in a taxi cab on the way to the airport to go home, they asked the cab driver, could you pull over at a little store? We want to get snacks because it's a long plane ride home. And he did. They got out, they got their items, they went up to the shopkeeper, and they thought, let's try one last time. And they pulled that list out and read it to him. Do you know these women, Janina, Maria, Bronya, Wajagut? He said, I never heard of them. But there was a woman who'd been shopping in the back of the store, and she came running up, grabbed the list out of their hand, pointed at one of the names, and said, this one is me. These others are my sisters. And so this couple was able to give my Aunt Bronya my mom's address, and 10 days later, Mom got, well, she called it a telegram from heaven, a telegram from all four of her sisters, saying, we found you, and we can't wait to see you. So after 4 decades, we got my mom a plane ticket back to Poland. I remember driving her to the airport. She was so excited, I think she could have flown there herself. She flew into Warsaw and then had to get on a small little commuter plane to go to the little village where her sisters lived. And I talked to her the very next day. She's so funny. She says, I was looking out the plane window for my four beautiful sisters, and there stood four gray-haired babushkas waiting for me. I can't imagine what that was like. I wished I could have been there to see her get off and hug this family that she didn't even think was alive, to be able to go into their homes to meet their families and to see her parents' grave sites. The truth is, when you live with an attitude of love, a belief that we're all one human family, and when you are willing to lay down the grievances, the things that hold you back and poison your heart and your mind, your life gets so amazing. You know, my mom started traveling and speaking so much that she really didn't do any interior design work. And speaking doesn't pay nearly as much as being an interior decorator, but that was okay. She was very happy doing what she was doing. But one day she came back from traveling somewhere in the country, and when she pulled in the driveway, her neighbor stopped her and said, Irene, we found your husband. He was wandering the streets. He couldn't remember how to get home. And we've kept him here with us. We knew my dad's memory was failing, but he had full-on Alzheimer's. There was not enough money to put him in a home. They're very expensive. There wasn't enough money to even hire somebody to watch him so she could go and travel. And I was already living in Washington State by then. And so sometime later, my mom was contacted by the Jewish Federation on the East Coast. They wanted her to come and speak, and she let them know that she couldn't and explained why and didn't think more of it. The Jewish Federation on the East Coast contacted the Jewish Federation in Los Angeles, and they got their heads together. And the next day, my mom received a phone call from the Jewish Home for the Aged in Reseda, California. It is a beautiful facility that took care of seniors, especially with Alzheimer's. There was only 3 really big problems with them. You had to be Jewish to go there at that time. It was very expensive, and there was a long waiting list. But that afternoon, the president of the Jewish Home for the Aged called my mother and said, Mrs. Opdyke, the Jewish community of North America has left us no alternative but to break every rule we've ever had. You bring your husband in this afternoon. We will love him. We will care for him like he was one of our own. And they continued, the Federation, to take care of my mom until she passed away. Because when you love someone, regardless of who they are, regardless of their differences, your life goes from this side to huge. In closing, if Mom were here, you'd see this tiny blonde bombshell who would say this one thing to you. One person can make a difference. The power of one is so incredible. Throughout history, you don't have to look very far to see that. The difference one person can make for good or for evil. And the truth is we have opportunity multiple times a day to show a kindness, to let somebody off the hook, to stop a joke that puts somebody down, to stand up against something that's wrong or stand up for something that's right, to befriend someone who's lonely. What a privilege that is. One person can make a difference. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Jeannie. We have a few minutes for questions. We'll have a couple of us in the aisles. Feel free to raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone to you.
What time frame was your mom under occupation? From the very beginning to the very end when the Soviets came over the border?
She was there right on day one when Hitler invaded September 1st, 39, and so she was there until the end of the war and then didn't leave Europe until 1949.
So she spent, how many years in a displaced person camp?
Almost two.
Mm-hmm. She's truly God was looking out for her because she was already on the list from the Soviets. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever meet your four aunts?
I did. All of them were able to come to Southern California, and I got to meet them. They were all short and white, fluffy hair. My mother loved Hawaii, and so she took all of her sisters and me to Hawaii. And the first thing they did was buy these god-awful colorful muumuus, matching ones. And as you can see, I'm not exactly short. And I led them around. I felt like Mother Goose with flowers behind me. So they were wonderful, sweet women, and it was a joy to get to meet them. Yes, yeah.
I just want to know what happened to the three sisters. Were they in camps or anything, or were they fine?
The four sisters, all their schooling was interrupted, unfortunately. They grew up extremely poor. They were farmed out first to relatives and then to neighbors and random people. They always lived and stayed close to each other. Three of them were married and had children. One wasn't. But they were extremely poor. They lived in these cement apartments where they had to have a community garden, and wherever that was, the ground was very affected by Chernobyl, and so they suffered some health problems because of that. But they did all stay together, but they didn't fare very well. Yeah.
How old was your mother when she passed, and how many years did she tour around and travel or talk?
She was 85 when she passed away. I believe she was probably 62-ish when she started speaking. And she had fallen and broke her hip. She had all kinds of health problems, cancer twice, diabetes. She was given a transfusion that gave her hepatitis C, but she just kept going and going. And when she passed away, suddenly, I found a little appointment book on her nightstand. She had almost 40 speaking engagements lined up for the future. And so I started calling to let people know, and several of them, there was one that was only 2 weeks away, and they said, "We've already done all the advertising. Can you come?" No. I was the kid who threw up having to do a book report in school, and God would not ask that of me. But, you know, it really sucks to be the daughter of a hero and say, "I can't stand in front of people and talk." So I went and sobbed through the whole thing. I don't think I had one word that anyone could understand, but It's now a passion of mine. And if you'd like, there's one story that I would tell you that really, because people will ask me what was my reaction when I was 14, and, you know, after she talked to that person on the phone. And the honest truth is, you're 14. You've got way more important things in your life to do than, you know, hear about a story like that. 14-year-olds have their own kind of importance. And so I'm ashamed to say that it didn't make much of a difference. But when I was 20, my mom asked me to go with her to a school that she was speaking at. She was invited to a high school in Watts in Los Angeles. This was the 70s, and this school was on the news nightly for gang violence. Gangs, shootings, stabbings. It was my mom's favorite kind of place to go to. And about a week before she was due to go there, the principal called her up and they said, "Mrs. Opdyke, I need to let you know that we've had a lot of anti-Semitic vandalism. People have spray-painted swastikas on the building and on the sidewalk, and this morning somebody has spray-painted on the steps leading to the school, 'Jew lovers stay home.' And we would totally understand if you would like to cancel." And my mother says, "I will not be intimidated by bullies." So he said, "Okay, then what I'd like you to do is stop at the LAPD, and an officer will escort you to the school, and he will stay with you and then bring you back to your car." And Mom says, "Oh, honey, that will not be necessary. My daughter, she will drive me." Yay. So I drive her there, and we pull into the parking lot, and school's just starting, and these students, and I use the word student really loosely because I could swear these guys were like 30 years old. They were big. And the gangs were evident. They walked together separately, and you could feel the hate between them, even in the parking lot. Mom's totally oblivious to this. She gets out, marches across the parking lot. I'm following behind her. And when we go in the school, the principal invites her to go into the office. He wants to talk to her, and he tells me to go in the gymnasium because that's where the assembly is going to be held. So I go in there, sit in the bleachers, the bell rings, and these students, they start coming in. They're loud, they're rowdy, and their language, I'd never even heard some of the things they said. And as I looked at their faces, there was only one thing I was absolutely positive of. The last place they wanted to be in the whole world was in there listening to some little old lady talk to them about the Holocaust. And at one point, the principal comes and stands in the middle of the basketball court to introduce my mom, I assume, because he's holding a microphone and his lips are moving. I can't hear a thing he's saying because it's so loud in there. And I remember sitting on the bleachers going, "This is going to be such a train wreck." And then here comes my mom from the end of the basketball court. She looks like a little white cotton ball walking across. And she grabs the microphone, and she bats her false eyelashes. "Good morning, my darling's childrens. I am so happy to be here, seeing all your beautiful faces. And I want you to know that I've come here today because I love you." It took me a few minutes to realize that it had gotten as quiet in there as it is right here. And what especially blew me away was afterwards, she stood in the middle of that court and the kids lined up. Kids that wouldn't even be in the same room together unless they were forced to were now standing in line together on their knees because they were so tall and she was so little to give her a hug and kiss. And I watched one after another hug her and then kneel back to the end of the line so they could do it again. And that's when it hit me, the power of love. When you can stand before people that are your perceived enemies and say, "I'm not afraid of you. I love you." It changed their lives, I'm sure, and it definitely changed my thinking after that.
Other than Roman, did she have any other contact with any more of the families?
You know, everybody in the basement was in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and because she was so young, except for one young woman, Fonka Zilberman, and she didn't know how to find her. It's another story, real quick, sorry. My mother calls me up. I'm already in Washington State, and she says, I am going to be on television. I said, that's so cool, Mom. What show? You'd think if you were going to be on television, you'd know whose show you were going to be on. But I hear her rifling through her papers, finally, oh, here it is. I'm going to be on the Mr. Jerry Springer show. What? No, he's a nice man. I'm like, Mom. Anyway, she gives me the date and the time, and I'm so freaked out because who knows what you're going to find out. So I don't tell a soul that she's going to be on the Jerry Springer show. And I remember watching it that morning, and he comes on and he says, today's show is unlike anyone I've ever done. Many of you don't know I'm Jewish, and I lost the majority of my family in the Holocaust. And then he brings out my mom, and they have a wonderful interview. And then he surprises her. We found from Munich, Germany, they brought in Roman Holler, and they sat and talked. And then he goes, and we have another surprise. From New York City, we found Fonka Zilberman, the other young girl in the basement. And it was a beautiful show, and I had nobody watch it at all. I do have the DVD, though, so, sheesh.
Okay. Have you captured these as oral histories, or is it written in books or anything?
My mother has a book out called In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer. She has 9 hours of tapes from the Shoah Foundation. She has a permanent exhibit in the Washington, D.C. Holocaust Memorial under Rescuers. She's received a commendation from the President and First Lady of Poland and from the Anti-Defamation League, the Courage to Care Award. So, and she's in multiple documentaries. And 8 months ago, I signed a contract to make a major motion picture of her story. So, God willing, maybe that will happen. Thank you.
This is a selfish question, but I bought the book a number of years ago, I think at the Holocaust Museum, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to sign it when
of course.
We're done. Okay,
thank you. That would be an
wonderful
honor.
Wonderful book.
You.
Wonderful book.
Thank you.
Did your mother ever speak here in Omaha?
There's a good chance she did. I haven't had anybody come up and tell me, and that's pretty unusual, but... you know, there's a good chance that she did. If there was people from the Jewish Federation here, I don't know if they are, that would have been back here, you know, involved 20 or 25 years ago, they would know for sure. But I think she was at just about everyone there was, so.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Jeannie Smith, the daughter of Polish Holocaust rescuer Irena Gott-Opdyk, who passed away on May 17, 2003. Irena, the author of In My Hands, Memories of a Holocaust Rescuer, received international recognition for her actions during the Holocaust while working for a high-ranking German official. Her life story was performed on Broadway in the nationally acclaimed play Irena's Vow, starring Tova Feltschu. This program, presented in partnership with the Institute for Holocaust Education, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 25, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.